Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with Drs. Francine Foss and Lynn Wilson. I'm Bruce Barber. Dr. Foss is a professor of medical oncology and dermatology, specializing in the treatment of lymphomas. Dr. Wilson is a professor of therapeutic radiology and an expert in the use of radiation to treat lung cancers and cutaneous lymphomas. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can contact the doctors directly. The address is canceranswers@yale.edu, and the phone number is 1-888-234-4YCC. This evening, Francine and Lynn are pleased to welcome Drs. Harriet Kluger and Mark Ferries. Dr. Kluger is an associate professor of medical oncology and a member of the Yale Cancer Center Melanoma Program, and Dr. Ferries is an associate professor of surgical oncology specializing in the treatment of melanoma. Here's Francine Foss.
Let's start off by a little education about melanoma. Could you tell us what is it?
So melanoma is a cancer that starts in the skin and starts in the pigment cells of the skin, and it is associated with excessive sun or ultraviolet radiation exposure, and is typically treated by surgery at an early stage and with medical therapy as it's at a more advanced stage. It's a concerning cancer because it's one of the fastest growing cancers in terms of incidence of any of the cancers.
So, Mark, you're new to Yale. Could you tell us a little bit about when you came to Yale, where you came from, and what your interests are?
So I'm just arriving at Yale. I'm coming from Santa Monica, California, so I didn't come for the weather. But there are some really great things about the melanoma program at Yale. One is it has a tremendous tradition in treatment of melanoma patients. The Yale Melanoma Unit goes back 35 years and has been led by Steve Arion over the years. But there are a lot of exciting things that are happening in the program now with Harriet and the Medical Oncology Group, with the new Smilo Cancer Hospital. So it's a great time to be here.
Harriet, tell us a little bit about your background. I know we've known each other a long time, and you've been at Yale a pretty long time, but tell us your background and how you got interested in melanoma.
Well, I came from a sunny place. I was born in South Africa, where we had a lot of sun exposure with the high altitude in Johannesburg. So became interested in it primarily from a personal perspective because myself and a number of relatives have had this problem. When I moved to Yale in 1999 as an oncologist, I decided to join the Yale Melanoma Unit because there was a lot of, for similar reasons to those that Mark gave, there was a lot going on at the time. There were a lot of opportunities for delivering novel therapies to melanoma patients as opposed to some diseases such as breast cancer where they've made much more progress. We sort of viewed this as an opportunity to make progress and to really contribute to a disease that really had for which we had very little to offer.
Harriet, can you just outline for us the melanoma program at Yale? I understand it's a multidisciplinary program. And could you just, for our listeners, go through the different types of folks who are participating in the program?
Yes, so we have physicians and scientists, and then we have hybrids who do both science and clinical work. On the clinical side, we have dedicated radiologists who come to our weekly meetings where we discuss patients. We have dedicated skin pathologists as well as surgical pathologists. We now have an epidemiologist who comes to our meetings and is involved in genetic screening of patients. We have surgeons, both on the plastic surgery side and the surgical oncology side. We have a radiation therapist who focuses on brain metastases from melanoma, a separate radiation therapist who does radiation in other parts of the body, and then we have the medical oncologists who deliver what we call systemic therapies, so therapies that are either injected or ingested. On the science side, we have Dr. Ruth Halaban, who is the lead basic scientists, and we have computational scientists as well, so people who analyze data from the high-throughput experiments that we do. We have a statistician as part of the group, and we have a number of other scientists who do a lot of melanoma-related research and drug development primarily.
Mark, how is the diagnosis usually made? And you had mentioned that there can be some different treatments depending on early versus later disease. Tell us about that. And since you're a surgeon, I take it you're probably involved in making this diagnosis fairly often.
Many times. Most often the diagnosis is made by a dermatologist or by the patient's primary care physician. And typically it will be a skin lesion that either the patient or the physician has noted that's unusual, that has some suspicious features to it. And the features that we look for are the ABCD characteristics, and that's A for asymmetry, something that's not nice and round or oval, B for an irregular or ragged border, C is for the color, which can have multiple colors in it, brown and red or blue and black, or a color that's different from the color of the patient's other moles, and D's diameter, which is a bit of a weak indicator, but the larger it is, the higher the risk. But really the thing to look for is a skin lesion that is different, that's unusual, that doesn't match up with the other things that a particular patient has on the skin. And that would raise someone's suspicion that it might be a problem and should lead, hopefully, to an early biopsy.
How are most melanomas diagnosed? Are they diagnosed because a patient notices something or a primary care physician notices something? I mean, what's the most common way that these are picked up?
It can be either way, and it depends a lot on the awareness of both the physician and the patient. And many times skin lesions can be ignored, both by the patient and by a physician, and the melanoma is allowed to progress to a more advanced stage. It's important that that doesn't happen. It's important that these are picked up early. The earlier the melanoma is picked up, the simpler the treatment, the more likely that the patient will be cured. And so at an early stage, we would simply excise that area with or without lymph node evaluation, and most of those patients will be fine.
And are these usually brand new, or is it a mole that might have been present for 30 years and starts to change, or are both scenarios possible?
Both are possible. And it's fairly equally distributed between the two. And so if you have a mole that has been there forever but has recently changed, that's something you should be concerned about. And if there is a new mole or a new dark spot that has appeared where there hadn't been anything before, that's the other typical way that it appears.
And do these have symptoms? Do they hurt or are they itchy or do they bleed?
They can. Often symptoms, though, come at a later stage. So optimally, melanoma would be picked up before there are any symptoms. Itching can sometimes be a symptom. And then bleeding, if a melanoma has gotten to the point where it has ulcerated, can happen as well.
Harriet, you mentioned epidemiology. I wonder if you could comment on whether there are any other associated risk factors for melanoma, such as family history or other genetic risk factors that we should be aware of.
Yes, there definitely are genetic risk factors that have been identified. For example, there's a gene called P16 gene, which is mutated in actually a very small percentage of patients with melanoma. There probably are a lot of additional genes that we haven't really identified yet. We do know for sure that the strongest risk factor for developing melanoma is sun exposure. The second one would be family history, genetics, and so on. The other risk factor, of course, is lifestyle, location where you live, how close to the equator, and so on.
Can we just interject here the average age for a patient with a melanoma? How young and how old?
So the peak incidence is in the 50s and 60s, melanoma is one of the cancers that spreads across almost the entire age spectrum. And because it can affect so many people at a young age and actually robs us of more productive years of life than just about any other cancer other than leukemias and lymphomas. And so it's unusual in very young children, but beyond that, everyone needs to be aware of melanoma as a possibility.
I was just going to ask about the increasing incidence in teenagers and young adults, perhaps related to tanning bed use.
We are concerned about any unnecessary excessive ultraviolet radiation exposure. And one of the groups that we've seen a great increase in melanoma in has been relatively young women, who tend to also be the ones who are most likely to use tanning beds. With the improved quality of some of the sunless tanning products that are available now, hopefully that will be less of an interest for some of these people.
So a patient sees their primary care physician and a biopsy is done and a diagnosis of melanoma is made. and the biopsy's just been done in the primary care physician's office. What's the course of events that that patient would traverse at that point?
Well, that's the point at which they're frequently would be referred to the melanoma unit, and typically to see one of the surgeons there, such as myself. One of the most important things that can happen is to have that biopsy looked at carefully, because we get a huge amount of information about how serious the melanoma is from the characteristics of that original biopsy. So it's important that the biopsy is done well and that it's examined well by an experienced pathologist. From that point, I would consult with the patient and then go over what the options are, what types of treatment are available, and the best course for them to really complete the picture of where they stand and then to get that original primary melanoma treated.
And both Mark and Harriet, why don't you take us through some of the treatment options for a patient?
So typically, the patient starts with surgery, so I'll let Mark go first.
Sure. So for melanomas that are clinically localized to that primary site, that is, there's no sign of any melanoma anywhere else, what we do is remove the area where that biopsy was performed, where the original lesion was, with a rim of normal-appearing tissue around the outside of it to be sure that every last cell that's in that area that we can get out, we get out. It ends up being a fairly sizable excision that we do to be as thorough as possible. And that's why reconstruction with plastic surgical techniques is important to be sure that the patients heal up as quickly and as normally as they can. In some instances, when there are characteristics of the melanoma that suggest it may have spread, the most likely place for it to spread to is to a lymph node in the area of that primary melanoma. And what we'll do in the modern area is something called a sentinel lymph node biopsy. And that's a way that we can tell which one or two lymph nodes generally are the ones that receive direct drainage of fluid from the tissues around the primary tumor site. Those are the lymph nodes that will hold any melanoma if it is spread. So we can evaluate those in a minimally invasive way and complete the picture of where the patient stands in terms of their treatment. And if there is more advanced disease or more significant involvement of the lymph nodes, then it may require additional surgery to remove more lymph nodes. And then the patient also begins to consider the possibility of medical or systemic treatment to decrease the chance of the melanoma showing up anywhere else.
So for systemic therapy, if the melanoma has only spread to the lymph node and it's been completely resected, the standard therapy at that point is a drug called interferon. We have a number of other experimental therapies that we're currently trying in clinical trials to see if we can improve the outcome and get better benefit than what we get from the interferon, which is a tough drug to take. Primarily, the focus is on immune therapy, so we're trying to boost the immune system to take care of any rogue melanoma cells that might have escaped beyond the lymph node that was just resected. If the melanoma has spread beyond the lymph node and is no longer resectable, then the patient has what we call stage 4 disease. And there too, we have a number of standard therapies and a number of experimental therapies, which you know we can discuss a little bit later on.
Thanks, guys. We're going to take a short break for a medical minute. Please stay tuned to learn more information about melanoma with Drs. Kluger and Ferries.
Breast cancer is the most common cancer in women. In Connecticut alone, approximately 3,000 women will be diagnosed with breast cancer this year and nearly 200,000 nationwide. But there is new hope for these women. Earlier detection, non-invasive treatments, and novel therapies provide more options for patients to fight breast cancer. In 2010, more women are learning to live with this disease than ever before. Women should schedule a baseline mammogram beginning at age 40 or earlier if they have risk factors associated with the disease. With screening, early detection, and a healthy lifestyle, breast cancer can be defeated. Clinical trials are currently underway at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers, such as Yale Cancer Center, to make innovative new treatments available to patients. A potential breakthrough in treating chemotherapy-resistant breast cancer is now being studied at Yale, combining BSI-101, a PARP inhibitor, with the chemotherapy drug irinotecan. This has been a Medical Minute, brought to you as a public service by the Yale Cancer Center. More information is available at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Lynn Wilson, and I'm joined by my co-host, Dr. Francine Foss. Today, we are joined by Dr. Harriet Kluger and Dr. Mark Ferries, and we're discussing melanoma. Harriet, before the break, we were talking about more advanced disease, and you were about to embark on giving us some more details about various treatment options. Why don't you discuss that with us and then talk to us a little bit about some of the clinical trials that are available for patients.
Okay. So once the melanoma has spread beyond the lymph node and is no longer resectable surgically, we have to try to treat the melanoma with either a drug that's ingested by mouth or something that's injected intravenously or subcutaneously. So the standard of care in our minds is a drug called high-dose interleukin-2. The drug has been available for well over a decade. The nice thing about this drug is that it's given in-house, but for a very brief period. They come in for 1 week, they go home for a week and come back for another week, and then if it's working, we do that again. It's tough to take while the patient is in-house, but once they're discharged a few days later, they really recover and they can go back to their normal lives. The patients that respond to that drug tend to have a really, really durable response. In fact, there were patients that were treated in the 1980s who've never had a recurrence. So for that reason, we tend to try to start with it for the robust patient who can tolerate it. There are a few chemotherapy drugs that have been given over the years. They do work in a percentage of patients, but the duration of response of those drugs tends to be a little bit more limited. We now have two new, very promising drugs that probably will be approved by the FDA soon. One is an immune therapy that we hope will be approved in a year for, I'm sorry, sometime in 2011. It's a drug called ipilimumab. I can test you afterwards if you see if you remember the name. But we just call it IPI for short. It's also an immune-based therapy. Essentially what it does is it takes the brakes off the immune system so we get some nonspecific immune activation. And there too, when patients respond, they tend to respond for a prolonged period of time. And patients also tend to live longer when they receive the ipilimumab. The other drug that's looking very promising is a targeted therapy developed by a company called Plexicon. There were a number of articles about this drug in the New York Times recently. Patients who have a certain mutation in their melanoma, it's approximately 50% of the melanoma patients, have dramatic responses to this drug as well. And the duration of response is probably in the order of 9 months.
Harriet, can you tell us how surgery is being integrated with medical oncology in terms of clinical trials and developing new strategies for treating these melanomas?
Yes. So sometimes we have a patient who has a single site of metastasis or a couple of sites of metastasis, and we can then give medical therapy before we go for surgery, and that kind of gives us an opportunity to learn a lot about the disease. We call that neoadjuvant treatment. And so sometimes we do that for patients whose disease is spread beyond the draining lymph node. Sometimes we only do it for regional disease as well. And perhaps Mark can elaborate on that a little bit because he's been involved in some of those trials at John Wayne Cancer Center in the past.
Sure. I mean, it just from a surgical perspective, the developments that Harriet has described with these new medical treatments, it's really exciting. And it's something that hasn't really happened in melanoma before, to have these new treatments that are effective when so few things have really been shown to be effective in the past. And what that allows us to do is that in some patients who have a response to some of these new treatments, but not a complete response, there's perhaps one or two lesions that are left in place that have not gone completely away, is to go ahead and remove those lesions surgically. And what we've seen with some of these systemic treatments where patients have partially responded is that if we go ahead and remove those other spots, those patients tend to do just about as well as the patients who had everything disappear on the medical therapy. And so it's a great, there's been a great increased interaction between the medical and the surgical parts of the therapy. But the other very important thing that allows us to do is to learn more about how the treatments work and specifically why they don't work. And so if there is a specific metastasis that has not gone away, We can remove that, both for the benefit of the patient, but also then to study that, to try to find out what characteristics are there that prevented that particular tumor from responding to the treatment. And by doing that, we can find out why those tumors are resistant and perhaps develop new therapies to overcome those resistance mechanisms.
So, Mark, would you ever give some of these biological therapies before you operated on a patient?
In the past, I would have definitely said if the tumor is resectable, we should resect it right away. We don't want to give it a chance to get to the point where we can't take it out. And in the past, the success for most of the chemotherapies and other more standard older medical treatments for melanoma, the success was so low that would be a pretty reasonable thing, I think, to say. But with the improved efficacy of a number of these treatments, the chance of getting a response and actually making it easier for us to do the surgery after the treatment is pretty good. And we learn more about the treatment by sequencing the treatments in those orders. So I think that will be something that we do more and more as time goes on.
Well, Harriet, we talk a lot about personalized medicine now and identifying specific mutations in a patient's tumor and then directing therapy toward those specific genes that are mutated. And you mentioned this new agent that's available targeting a specific mutation in melanoma. Could you just talk a little bit about that?
Yes, I think it's the first incidence in cancer treatment where there's a specific mutation that actually drives the cancer cell and it's not found in other cells in the body. So that enables us to give a drug that targets that particular mutation and only that mutation and doesn't affect normal cells to the degree that other cancer therapies do. So this enabled the developers of the drug to push the doses up in patients with very little side effects. And that's probably why this drug is so effective. So, for example, in breast cancer, you give targeted therapies as well, tamoxifen or anti-hormonal therapy. That's a targeted therapy against estrogen receptor. But because estrogen receptor is located in other parts of the body, too, you're limited in how much of the drug you can give in order to kill the cancer cells. So that's probably why this drug has been so effective in melanoma. And we're hoping that going forward, we're going to find additional mutations that drive other subsets of melanomas. So, for example, we know that another 15% of the melanomas are driven by a mutation called an NRAS mutation. So if we had a drug that specifically targeted those NRAS mutations, we may be able to use that as well. And we're hoping that in the future we'll have a menu of drugs that we can give, and from the menu we pick the best thing for the patient. I think the flip side of that is trying to identify which of the patients are going to respond to the immune therapies that we mentioned, because there the predictor would supposedly be found in the immune system and not in the tumor, although we don't really know that yet.
So where are we in terms of personalized medicine in melanoma? Are these particular mutations screened for in all melanoma patients at this point in time?
We do it at Yale as part of a research program. We have a grant called a SPOR grant, which stands for Special Programs of Research Excellence. It's a grant that's been given to us by the National Cancer Institute, and we're one of five melanoma sites. The SPOR has some funding and what we call a tissue core, so all of the specimens go to the core, and that gives us the opportunity to actually screen for these mutations. If it's done in a routine pathology lab, sometimes we have issues with payment for the mutational analysis because it's not yet been FDA approved and it's not recognized by all insurances.
Do we think that the incidence of melanoma is increasing in Connecticut because the disease is more common, or is it because we're better at screening and detection, or both? What's your sense about that?
So we think it's a combination of both. Certainly, nationally, the incidence is increasing, but also the death rate for melanoma is increasing, which leads one to believe that some degree of this might be a true increase in incidence rather than just an increase in diagnoses because people are more aware. Even though our latitude is fairly far north, we still have a fairly large fair population over here. We have the shoreline and lakes, and people are outdoors quite a bit despite our weather.
And do we have screening programs at Yale that are offered from time to time?
Yes, Yale Dermatology Associates does have, firstly, a free screening day where people can walk in and get a full-body skin screen. And there are dermatologists within the dermatology department that focus on screening for melanoma. That's sort of the area of interest and the area of research interest. So we have a bunch of really competent dermatologists who do this on a regular basis.
So, Mark, for a patient who had, say, one of these very early superficial melanomas removed, of which there are a growing number of patients out there now, what kind of follow-up should that patient expect?
So the patient, there are really two things for the patient to watch out for as time goes on. The first is that the possibility that that first melanoma might come back, might have spread somewhere else and might reappear. And the risk of that depends a lot on the characteristics of the original primary and then whether the nodes were involved or not. Typically, that risk is fairly low. And the patient can be followed with physical examinations and just regular routine testing. The other risk, though, that patients need to worry about once they've had one melanoma is the risk of getting a second melanoma. And that risk is substantially higher than the risk for someone who's never had a melanoma. And over the course of the rest of their life, it might be between 5 and 10%. So it's not a huge risk, but it's substantial, and particularly compared to patients that have never had a melanoma. And so the most important component of the follow-up for that is regular skin examinations. And that can be with the surgical oncologist, it can be with the dermatologist, their primary care physician, and they can check themselves as well. But if they undergo that sort of a regular surveillance program, chances are if they do get a second melanoma, it will be caught at least as early or usually earlier than the first one and shouldn't be a threat to their life and can be treated and cured as well.
Mark, just getting back to the biopsy or excision procedure and the sentinel lymph node procedure, is that something that a patient would have to stay overnight in the hospital for, or do they go home that day? And what are some of the side effects that might be associated with, say, a sentinel lymph node procedure?
So the sentinel node procedure is a minimally invasive procedure. It's outpatient surgery. It involves first a test, which is a radiology test, where the site of the primary melanoma is injected with a bit of a radioactive tracer that then can be followed to where this sentinel lymph node is. And then during the surgery, we also inject a blue dye that allows us to see the sentinel node as well. We find through a small incision that node that has taken up those tracers, take that node out, and close up the little incision. The patient can then go home the same day and return to work generally within a day or two. If that lymph node is okay, then that means the rest of the lymph nodes are almost certainly okay as well, and they can avoid any other more invasive, more substantial operations.
Harriet, you talked about the SPOR grant at Yale, which is a research grant for melanoma. I wonder if you could talk to us a little bit about clinical trials, ongoing clinical trials, and new developments in melanoma.
Yeah, so we have a number of experimental therapies that we can offer patients that aren't available in routine oncology practices. When we look at clinical trials and drug development, we go through a bunch of phases. So some of these drugs are in early phase of development, some are in later stages of development, and we definitely have some really exciting immune-based therapies in the pipeline right now that hopefully within a year or two will be expanded, and we've seen some very nice responses to some of them. But on a regular basis, we typically have about 6 different experimental therapies available for patients with metastatic melanoma.
Dr. Harriet Kluger is an associate professor of medical oncology and a member of the Yale Cancer Center Melanoma Program. Dr. Mark Ferries is an associate professor of surgical oncology specializing in the treatment of melanoma. If you have questions for the doctors or would like to share your comments, visit yalecancercenter.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and find written transcripts of past programs. I'm Bruce Barber, and you're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.